Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Teevil and I'm your host for this hour. We got a great show for you lined up today. We're going to be starting out with a really fascinating interview with Dr. Esther Van Wagner, who's a professor at the School of Law at the University of Victoria. And we're going to be talking about the Cowichan Tribes decision. Which is a decision that came out in August affecting Cowichan Tribes and Richmond. It's actually called Cowichan Tribes versus Canada. And in that decision, in a longstanding land claims case, it actually had an effect on some of the private property rights within that land claim area. And we're going to talk about that. It's a pretty in-depth interview. The whole thing is about half an hour, comes in three parts. The first part, we're going to be talking about the Cowichan Tribes versus Canada case down in Richmond. In the second part of the interview, we're going to be talking about just what is Aboriginal title. It's a really important concept that ties into both that specific case, but the whole discussion around what this case means for British Columbia, because the issue of Aboriginal title, because of the lack of treaties here, is quite important. And then we're going to get back to, in part three of the interview, talking about what the impact of this case really is. There's a ton of online discussion around this case, and a number of folks are doing political organizing around it, I would say, and you see that in a lot of online comment spaces on Reddit and elsewhere. And not all the information seems to be accurate. We're not going to be getting into refuting anybody's particular claims. We're just going to be talking about the case. But I think if you listen to this interview, if you listen to what Dr. Van Wagner has to say, she's an expert. She teaches courses in just the topics that we're going to be discussing. And so she's really well prepared to talk about it and make it clear to those of us who aren't lawyers. So here's the interview. Sit down and buckle up. It's a lot of detailed information and serious topics, but I think it's extremely worth your listen. All right. Welcome, Dr. Esther Van Wagner. You're an associate professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Victoria. Thanks for speaking to me today. So you're a professor at the UVic Law School, and some of your research has specialized in Aboriginal title, Indigenous property, and land use systems. Can you just talk a bit about your background there?
Sure. Thanks very much for having me and inviting me to talk about this. So I am a property law professor, and one of the kind of strands of my research is really about this intersection of the common law and Indigenous law in terms of decision making about land use and environmental impacts and natural resource development. So I have a project that's actually based on Vancouver Island to try to think through some of the complications of places where there haven't been treaties negotiated, where there's a kind of mixture of fee simple and crown land and Indigenous land rights, and what we should do to move forward in those places and to live together in a good way.
So in August, a decision was handed down in BC Supreme Court in a land claim case by the Cowichan Tribes, which is the same as the Cowichan Nation. Cowichan Tribe sounds like a very old-fashioned term, but all about a parcel of land on the Fraser River in Richmond, and the sort of outcome of that case raised alarms and continues to be a source of discussion here in the province. What was that land decision?
So that case is a the resolution of a long-standing claim to Aboriginal title to a very small area in the south part of the Fraser River, where the Cowichan Nation has traditionally had a fishing village and very important cultural connections to that place, in addition to the territories that they have on Vancouver Island. So the group of nations that together have called themselves the Cowichan Nation Alliance for the purposes of bringing this have for many, many generations taken issue with the fact that areas of their territory on the Fraser were granted away to settlers without any compensation, without any treaty, without any consultation. And so Aboriginal title claims are one way that nations in a situation like that can pursue a legal remedy for those historic wrongs. So this case decided that the Cowichan Nation had in fact made out that claim and declared their Aboriginal title to the territory, to a portion, not the full area that they had claimed, but to a portion of that area. And it did so with two different kind of effects. So there's some areas of the title claim where the title is held by the Crown or the City of Richmond, so government entities. And in those places, the declaration of Aboriginal title was made, and it was also found that the title of Canada and Richmond was invalid, and that title is returned to the Cowichan Nation member nations. But there's another area, part of the area, where it's individual fee simple holders, not Crown or government entities. And in that area, the fee simple title held by those persons or companies was not found to be invalid. And that was not requested by the nations. So that wasn't a remedy that they were seeking.
Right. So is that distinction, though, because part of what I hear when I hear that is that those private property fee simple rights weren't affected in part because they weren't part of the claim. So
they were part of the claim.
Yeah.
So they were part of the claim in the sense that Aboriginal title was declared for the area encompassing both the government entities and the private fee simple holders. Mm-hmm. But the remedy for that was different for certain portions of the claimed area than others. So where there were those government entities holding a fee simple title, there was a request by the nations to have those titles declared invalid, which will facilitate the return of those lands. Mm-hmm. But the nations did not request that same remedy with respect to the private fee simple holders. And so the court did not declare them invalid. And so it has a very different effect on the future of those property holders.
So does that mean that in a different case or in a future case, that remedy could be requested and that question remains unresolved?
So what it means is that the Cowichan Nation has the underlying Aboriginal title and it coexists with the fee simple. We don't have yet a clear picture what that means, so the end parties could go to court and ask to clarify that. And it is possible for the nations to ask for a different kind of remedy vis-a-vis other parcels of land, but that has not been done. And it is not at all clear what the outcome would be. There are different kinds of considerations and different factual aspects of the history of those different parcels and who's holding them now that would be considered by the court. So certainly not a foregone conclusion that you would end up in the same situation. We simply don't know, but the parties would have the right to go to court and ask for remedies or ask for clarification. But the court has made it very clear that, in fact, it is the Crown's job to facilitate a solution for the coexistence of those interests. So the Cowichan Nation hasn't done anything wrong by asking for clarification of their title to these areas and righting the historic wrongs of interest being granted without their consent or any compensation or consultation, that it was the Crown's wrong. And so the Crown should be doing work to figure out how to reconcile those interests. And in fact, this government has done some really creative things in terms of figuring out what the relationship between Crown and Indigenous interests and even third party interests in the context of places like Haida Gwaii. So we know that it is possible to think creatively and find transformative solutions, but we have yet to see the Crown take those steps in this case.
So a short way of saying what the court said is that they're telling that the appropriate way for the government to deal with this is through negotiation rather than letting things work their way through the courts.
Yes, okay. That's right.
So one thing I've read about this case that, and I'm wondering how significant this is that one aspect of it is that this area of land was in fact previously granted to the Cowichan in some sort of claim. And then, again, this is what I've read online with different stories, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've basically kind of defrauded out of that land again by either the government or the land commissioner, so it could ultimately be resold. That is that something that you've heard?
There is a very convoluted history of this land, but I think the really important, simple version is that this is historically, on the facts, the court found that it clearly is historically territory of the Cowichan Nation, and that any of the decisions, the grants that had been made were done, it was done unlawfully. And so that gets us to the situation now where the Aboriginal title still coexists. It was never extinguished lawfully. And there certainly were some very problematic dealings by agents of the Crown. And some of that, it's a very complex. That's why the decision is 800 pages long. I think the important thing would be that Aboriginal title is not recognition of a prior grant of the land or anything like that. It's a recognition of the historic, pre-existing, inherent right of the nation because of their occupation and use and relationship to that land. So it's not really about, you know, how those dealings happen to either recognize Cowichan's territory in the past in that sense through any kind of grant. It's about that historic pre-existing relationship with the territory and governance of the territory that's being recognized. So Aboriginal title doesn't create those rights, and they're not derived from the Crown in any way. It recognizes that inherent relationship to the land.
Right. And now we'll switch to part two. We're doing this is an interview with Dr. Esther Van Wagner on the Cowichan Tribe's Richmond land claims decision. Decision came out in August and has been a topic of discussion as something that may radically change the way the relationship between First Nations and the rest of the province, and particularly the relationship between around private property rights. And that's what we're trying to talk about here. In the next part of the interview, we get into the topic of just what is Aboriginal title, which is really a core issue, not only in this case, but pretty much in, well, it is the central sort of central concept around land claims throughout the province and the ongoing treaty process here in BC. So let's talk a bit about Aboriginal title then, because there's, you've talked about how it coexists with fee simpler private property rights. So there's Aboriginal title here. There's the Crown lands, which is a kind of ownership. There's the provinces and the federal government sort of sovereignty over this territory we call British Columbia and Canada. How do those things relate?
Sure. I mean, I'm you know, I'm teaching property right now. I'll sort of teach this for the whole year, so this will be a very simplified mini version of. But the there's different ways of recognizing property relations. So the Crown has certain kinds of lawmaking power with respect to land that flows from the Constitution, and the province and the federal government have that for their respective Crown lands. And then there's also ownership of rights of the Crown for their respective lands and the ability to make certain decisions by virtue of that ownership. And in the case of the province, that's recognized by Section 109 of the Constitution. And in that section, it says subject to any other interests. And it's clear from the case law that Aboriginal title is one of those interests that the provincial Crown's land holding and powers associated with are subject to. So even the Crown doesn't have that kind of unlimited property right. All of the property rights outside of the protected Section 35 Aboriginal title rights in the Canadian legal system are derived of the Crown. So I just taught my property students about this. We exist in an estate system that's derived from the tenurial system. And so we still, in Canada, hold our property of the Crown.
Throughout the province, there are many, many
ownership in our system. The Crown has an underlying title, and we get a kind of what we refer to it as in property law as a slice of time in the land. And fee simple represents one of the largest sets of rights that we associate with an estate in land. But it's always of the Crown. And as this decision makes clear, those interests are not absolute. We decide to limit them in a bunch of different ways, including municipal zoning, including environmental regulations. And Aboriginal title, while it is the common law's way of understanding the Indigenous interests in land rooted in pre-existing societies being here, governing those places, having relationships with those places, it is unique because it's not derived from the Crown like those other interests. So its content, what is being recognized there, is not simply an Indigenous version of a fee simple. It's unique, and it is sourced in a very different way. And that goes into some of what was decided in the decision, that the recognition of Aboriginal title is not subject to things like the Land Titles Act, because it's not a Crown-derived interest. So it is regulated and limited, while not absolute. The limitations that apply to it are unique from the limitations that apply to fee simple.
All right. Well, that does a pretty good job. So they're really quite different origins, and that is a lot of the basis for how they operate differently.
And I think, you know, it's important to recognize that Aboriginal title is not something that comes from or is a representation of any particular Indigenous legal order. It's very much the Canadian common law's way of trying to reconcile the fact that there is an extinguished, pre-existing relationships with the territory that have to be recognized, that have not been lawfully dealt with. And so we have to have some legal way of reconciling the Crown's interest in the land and actions in relation to the land with that Indigenous interest in the land. And once Aboriginal title is declared, that relationship becomes unique in Canadian property relations.
A term I often hear related to this is about the extinguishment of Aboriginal title. But the way you describe it doesn't really sound like there's even a need to extinguish Aboriginal title for things, for the various components to work together.
So extinguishment was historically sought by the Crown, and we see historic treaties in different parts of Canada as attempts to do that. Now, I would caution that I think the many Indigenous signatories of different historic treaties would say that those treaties did not, in fact, and I think there's lots of historic evidence, but nonetheless, that was one effort to do that. But by the time Canada entered, or BC entered into the terms of the Union to join Canada, there was a policy that simply said, well, Indigenous interests in land don't exist. And there were no treaties negotiated apart from a very small number of treaties on Vancouver Island. And the that attempt to erase these legal relations with land that in other places had at least been kind of perfunctorily recognized through treaties has left BC in a particularly complex situation, because it now means that it's the site of this these very complicated legal actions where Aboriginal title was never really addressed in the settlement of the territory and the development of the territory. Once Section 35 and the 1982 Constitution was enacted, it's not possible anymore to extinguish Aboriginal title or Aboriginal rights. So now it has to be dealt with through a framework that the courts have established called a justified infringement. And so that's part of the analysis that you'd see in that case. Right. But a very important part of this case is looking historically at the way that extinguishment could and couldn't happen. And in fact, the province did not have the authority to extinguish Aboriginal title or Indigenous rights and interests in land. Only the Dominion and then the federal government was able to do that. And so a huge issue that arises in the context of BC is that these actions were taken without authority to lawfully transform land into fee simple or into Crown land and grant third party interests. So in this case, there was a really detailed dive into what the context of those grants to understand whether they were done lawfully and whether there was authority, because the province, its denial of Aboriginal title as a policy position doesn't actually change the law as much as they would have liked it to.
Right. You're listening to an interview with Dr. Esther Van Wagner of the University of Victoria School of Law. We're talking about the Couch and Tribes Richmond Land Claims Decision, formerly known as Couch and Tribes versus Canada. It came out in August and has been a fairly major topic of discussion for its potential effects on property rights, among other things, in the province of British Columbia. For the final part of the discussion, we're going to move on to a bit more of a discussion of just of that issue itself. What does all this mean for property rights here in British Columbia? Throughout the province, there are many, many land claims from many nations covering and often overlapping. And within all those land claims, there is lots and lots of private property and crown land. What does this decision mean for all that? And is it something that the courts are even going to be able to handle, or, you know, is it going to be down to negotiation?
I think this case makes clear, and in fact, all Aboriginal title cases, I mean, we've really only seen this go to the Supreme Court and have a final determination of this in the case of the Socotine. So it's a pretty rare occurrence at this point in time. But in that case, and in some of the other relevant cases, we have seen the fee simple private property holders carved out. So we didn't necessarily see those issues dealt with because the plaintiffs chose not to deal with those issues at some point in their decision making. So what's happening in this case is not kind of the creation of new law or new kind of precedent. It's just applying it to a different fact scenario. And I think that that's really lost in a lot of the conversation here. And I think that that's creating some of the kind of alarmist dialogue that's happening, is that this isn't new law. It's a fact scenario that the court was asked to deal with, and it applied the law as it existed through those cases that have made it through the courts before to a situation in which the nations included a bunch of different parcels of land. So every single Aboriginal title case is going to be dealt with in a very specific case-by-case factual basis. The facts here are, you know, hundreds of pages long in determining what actually happened, when the land was transferred, what kind of surveys had occurred, who had seen who dealing with the land. Every case is going to have that kind of scenario. So there's no way to predict that this factual finding in this case and the legal decision that follows from that means anything in particular. Right. And this case didn't create the possibility that this legal framework of Aboriginal title could be applied to fee simple. That's, anyone who's worked in this area has known that this issue has been around forever and was bound to come to the courts, and in fact has been in the courts in various ways at particular moments. This isn't even the first case to raise it as a potential issue. And we have actually seen the Crown kind of fail to be proactive about this and address it. And so the fact that this is a surprise to some is really at the hands of the Crown in not ensuring that people are informed and that they're rolling out a process to make sure that these conversations are happening in a good way. You know, I think there's a tremendous amount to be taken from the fact that the Cowichan Nation did not ask for a declaration of invalidity of those other private holdings, and that many claims have excluded those before, because these are their neighbors. These are their communities, right? They're seeking justice of a historic wrong, but not by creating further wrongs, by trying to figure out how we can all be good neighbors to each other and find ways through that are bringing together Cowichan law and the common law and perhaps creating something entirely new. To me, this is an opportunity to think about, well, what do we want to create that is of this place, right? Do we need frameworks that have come from England to tell us how we should be neighbors with each other and how we should interface with these lands? You know, perhaps there's things we want to take from that, but perhaps there's things we want to take from Cowdson law about what it means to live here and be good neighbors to each other. I think if folks took the opportunity to actually learn about Cowdson law or other indigenous legal orders, there would probably be a lot of comfort in the fact that these governance models and frameworks have been dealing with issues of conflict and overlapping interests and how to manage land and territory for many, many generations, and have tools that we can, as non-Indigenous peoples, perhaps link into and find ourselves learning from as we figure out these complicated questions.
Yeah. So sort of to finish up, you know, if I understand it for everything you've said to me, and it's been a lot.
Yes, sorry. There's a lot to say.
You know, the way forward on this, kind of in the long run, because it sounds like it will be a long run, is is that, you know, within our legal system and understanding of property rights, Aboriginal title needs to be integrated into that, kind of in the same way that, you know, the provincial, you know, and federal sovereignty and the rights of municipalities, because there are already very sort of influences in and ways in which the different bodies have some say in what happens on this kind of land. And this is not something completely different and not in opposition, just, well, I wouldn't say new, but newly considered in that larger equation.
Yeah, I think this makes clear that the intersocietal and multi-juridical space that we're living in has to be faced head on, that we have to address the fact that this is a place in which different legal orders are intersecting, and at times that's going to create opportunities, and at times it's going to create challenges. But I think really expecting all of us to enter into it in good faith and in a good way will lead to better outcomes and solutions than the kind of alarmist and fear-based thinking that we've seen from a lot of parties. And so I hope that folks will, you know, read the case and talk to people with knowledge of the history and of Cowdson law and try to inform themselves about what a different future might look like for those places.
Well, that seems like a great place to end it for today. Thanks so much for speaking to me. It really is a very complex issue, but you know, I think a lot of that complexity is sort of lost in the more in a lot of the discussion that goes on. And I think if we can cut through that complexity, it isn't as scary as it sometimes seems.
Yeah.
But it's also a lot of work to be done by all the parties.
Absolutely. A lot of work to be done. And I think, you know, the hope is that we can turn a page here and start doing that together rather than in opposition to each other.
Well, Dr. Esther Van Wagner, thank you so much. Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law at UVic. Very enlightening conversation today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad you're covering this issue.
Good. Thank you. And thanks to Dr. Esther Van Wagner for speaking to us about that. As you can tell, it's a pretty complicated topic with a lot of moving parts, and it's no wonder that things like, perhaps no wonder, that the treaty process itself, negotiation process here in Vancouver moves, or Vancouver in British Columbia moves, so slowly. Thank you to Dr. Van Wagner for really breaking it down and I think covering an awful lot of ground and providing an awful lot of information in a fairly compact, pretty easy to understand package, as she mentioned in the interview. She teaches a year-long course on these property rights issues, not just as related to Indigenous title, but and so, you know, it's a big and complicated topic, and I really appreciate how she was able to sort of bring it down and make it something comprehensible for those of us here on the radio. I hope you enjoyed that interview. There's a lot in it. If you want to listen to it again, we will be posting this program up on our website by this afternoon, and you'll be able to listen to it there. Just go to our homepage. And you can find it, and we'll also be putting it up on our SoundCloud, which you can find at soundcloud.com/CJSFFM. And a whole bunch of other content created, interviews and stories and other stuff created by our reporters and programmers and volunteers here at CJSF 90.1 FM. Now it's time for a little bit of Bird Note, a bit more of a lighter topic, help us relax a little bit.
This is Bird Note. When the air is thick with wildfire smoke, people are advised to stay home. But birds don't have weather apps, so what do? Acorn woodpeckers are extremely social. They live in family groups that cooperate to raise young and to cache food in a communal granary. They often visit their neighbors, too, which can help young birds find mates or establish new territories. To study these social networks, scientists have been using tiny radio transmitters to track the movements of acorn woodpeckers in a nature preserve near Monterey, California. In the summer of 2020, when nearby wildfires blanketed the area in heavy smoke, the birds responded to poor air quality, much like people do. On smoky days, woodpeckers spent more of their time at home. And when they did leave their territories, they didn't venture far and visited fewer neighbors than usual. The researchers calculated that from 2016 to 2020, almost 90% of the U.S. range of acorn woodpeckers experienced similarly smoky conditions at some point each year. That's a lot of birds whose lives and community ties are being disrupted by wildfire smoke. Learn more about what you can do to help ensure that we all have clean air to breathe when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
And we are well into the Christmas season here at CJSF, and of course, for you at home, if you celebrate Christmas, that is. Not everybody does. But it is a gift-giving season, and we have a special edition of Gardening with Embark with our expert Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability. And he's going to be talking about gifts for the gardeners in your life. He's got a lot of great ideas. So here's our talk. All right, welcome to a special holiday edition of Gardening with Embark. And joining me here in the studio is our gardens expert, Pablo Vimas. And we're going to talk about gifts for gardeners, what you can get for the gardeners in your life that they're going to like.
Hello, everyone. We are in week 49, and our mind and body is thinking, okay, it's time to relax, try to catch up with the weather, try to catch up with our health. And at the same time, we know the festivities are close by and start thinking what we can buy or give to our friends, mm-hmm. Or to ourselves as a gardener. So there are many things that we can do, and we can group in sections like tools, supplies, some clothes and others. So we gardeners love tools,
And one thing is great is the whole range of sort of price ranges for these things. There's little things all the way up to significant gifts.
Correct. So, yeah, it could be tools, for instance, bypass pruner, which will be low cost to a full power tool set. Because we gardeners are like, by a spring we are in building mode. There is no gardener that is not in building mode in a spring. So power tools, we always glad to have an extra battery, so we don't have all our power tools just died on us during the, last season. So that is the thing that we can focus on too. Certainly, during the winter season, we do lots of pruning at our trees, our shrubs, our native plants. So pruners or a folding saw, which is always useful to have a hand. So that's very much in this winter season. And together with that, we can have, we're always on knees. So a knee pad, a knee or a knee mat, a small a stool where we can sit down and continue doing our pruning activities. What else we can talk about? It is a time that we, like today, it's rainy, and we still are in gardening mode and planning to store our tools.
Yeah.
And before our tools are stored, of course, we clean, we sharpen the edges of our shovels, they sharpen the edges of our pruners. So as sharpening tool, sharpening a stone is quite good for this time of the season, because we are just cleaning and trying to store all our tools. So when the spring comes, everything is ready to go. So that's quite a...
I see you have a tool bag here too. I don't know about you, but I'm always someone, I have my tool and then I get up to do something and I carry it off with me and put it down, and then I go back and say, where the hell did I put that down?
That's right. Okay. So that brings us to a safety, how you call it, flagging tape. Flagging tape, colorful flagging tape, or a colorful orange neon duct tape. So all my tools are orange neon duct taped. Because in the field, in the garden, as you say, I'm doing this and doing that and just put my tool there, and later I spend more than half an hour looking where the tool is. So anything that makes the tool pop out in the garden, so it's orange duct tape, that is a must in my garden. So all my tools have are taped with this orange, so I know where they are. I have lost some of them. I remember once I was working with my hammer and didn't know where it was until I emptied the composter, and it was in there. So yeah, that's a good good thing to have it. Yeah, toolbox. That's interesting, because when you go to the garden, if the garden is not close to your home, or you have an allotment or somewhere else, a community garden, you need to bring your own tools.
Right.
There are tools that the community garden offers, but sometimes they are in the best shape or somebody is using, and you have to wait till they are free. So you carry your own tools with you. So either is a tap, a 5 gallon tap, or a proper tool bag where you can have your own stuff. So yeah, a gardener without tools or seeds, you delay the stuff, you work. And then we have supplies, kind of supplies. We have Sharpies, because spring will arrive and we have to label. So label, plant labels and Sharpies that are go together. So how, and then we say, well, plant labels, I try to use plastic labels, not to use popsicle sticks, because those don't last 3 weeks. They are all rotting, and they don't last. So although we are trying to be sustainable and environmental friendly, but just plastic still is the only thing that I do is make sure that my plastic labels, I use Sharpie, and I will say, well, how I clean that? So actually there is a product that is environmental friendly to remove graffiti. So I use that product to spray on a rack and clean my plastic labels, and the Sharpie just cleans.
And then you can reuse them.
You can reuse
them.
So those are these three things. So it could be plastic labels, Sharpies, and these graffiti removal, environmental friendly. We can have cotton twine. Again, the season will arrive. We have to be fixing the plants to the trellises, guiding them. So cotton twine is quite helpful. Yep. And again, not to lose, you can have a nice container with colorful designs where you can store your twine and bring all together to the garden. It's better to have something which is metal rather than glass. Glass might fall, break, and then you have to deal with all this broken glass.
Right.
So something that my last a tumble or something is being squished there. So something that's plastic or metal will do the job.
Yep.
Winter is here, so and we still are doing our set of gloves, which we always welcome a set of gloves, nice gloves. Will be nice to have waterproof winter gloves.
Yep.
Yeah, so which are waterproof, rubberized, and inside they are nice, warm, felty. So yeah, so you can still continue. We still can continue doing our gardeners, even if the weather is out cold.
And all those items would make great stocking stuffers too, because it's just sort of, you know, not a lot of cost, but fun and super useful.
Super useful, yeah. And there is a folding knife as well. So you know, there are lots of things to do, and you need to cut, and there is no scissors at hand. So a pocket knife as well would be quite nice. Yeah. So the summer will arrive, and then we can see that we start getting our farmer's tan. When summer arrives, our arms are completely brown, our face, neck, so anything that help us to protect from the sun, like sleeves, bandana, a hat, which is I tend to use a hat, just to protect my ears, the tip of my nose. You know, those are areas that really you can get skin cancer, and you don't want to have that.
Yep.
So let's protect that with using a hat with a large brim, so it's protect all your face and neck, and yes, the arms and sleeves. And nowadays, as well, there are beautiful gardening aprons. It could be in this strong leather, or it could be this, canvas, very strong canvas as well. So, an apron, which is quite nice when you have to harvest, because you just fold that and collect that.
Right.
And talking harvesting, a harvesting basket as well. Yeah. It's another tool that we super love it. I usually have with me harvesting beans, which are these dish pans that we use for camping. So always, and they are, I always bring with me to the garden. Even now in winter, there's always something to harvest and you put in there and ready to wash and bring it home. As well, our hands get very rough during this time.
Yeah.
So an ointment that makes them nice and smooth. Over the summer, any sun cream that is not too sticky and without a scent. I try to be in the, not to avoid anything that has a scent in the garden because we don't know how the insects will react to it.
Right.
So I don't want to be an attraction to insects and the bees and bumblebees all about my face and body, like, hey, what happened? Well, you are quite scenty.
But, smell like a flower.
You look like a flower. So some insects might get so upset and they sting you with no reason. So that we as well at this moment, we like to have magazines, a membership in the magazine, or calendar. There are garden calendars. At the moment, we have the Earth and Soil magazine that is located in Langley. It's a local magazine.
Oh, nice.
They follow the biodynamics philosophy. So gardening with the moon, gardening following the phases of the moon. So there's a full, beautiful calendar that they publish every December. So at the moment, they are, you can visit their website and order your calendar, so you can follow the moon's phases, so you can do all your activities, gardening activities.
I imagine as a calendar, it sort of got the sort of recommendations for what's happening at different times as you go through the year, you know, and local, which of course is really important.
Very important. So that's intense. If you are into, say, I had my experience with permaculture, I would like to diversify my knowledge, let's go to biodynamics, and that is another philosophy that we can experiment and learn from. So that's Any other garden magazine would be
awesome. And that's called Heart and Soil?
Heart and Soil.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's quite nice. Also, they have a beautiful website, and they carry, they host workshops, online workshops for any garden that's interested too. So that's quite good. Seeds. Yes, seeds. Oh, we gardeners, we love seeds. So at the moment, I know that the West Coast Seeds, which is very popular in our environment, and already have published their new magazine, Seed Mag, for the coming year.
Seed Catalog?
Yeah, the Seed Catalog. So again, you can go to online or visit one of the garden centers and grab your Seed Catalog for the coming year. Yeah. So you can spend all these rainy days inside observing and making your garden your seed list. So when January arrives, you can immediately place your order and have your seeds by March. So I think those are some of the things that what else will be for will be not a container where you can have your seeds.
Right,
it's easy. You get all these beautiful seed packets, lots of them, and then you are looking for a container where to store them and and know where they are when you need them.
Right.
Yeah. So
and seeds, if they're properly stored, they're going to last quite a long time. Like you may order a bunch of seeds, not use all of them right away, and if you store them properly, you could use them next year.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is the...
And of course, like you say, remember where you put them.
Correct. Yeah. So you get your seeds. As if you don't use all of them, you can store it, but you need a proper container so you know where they are. Otherwise, we tend to put in here and store in here and let you are looking. Where are my radishes? I know they have a packet of radishes, but you cannot find it. And then you have to go and buy and let you, when you are tidying up, you find your packet.
So do you favor like a separate container for each sort of seed or sort of a collective box where with a lot of slots?
Oh, what I do is I have separate things or containers for my seeds, which are grouped.
Mm-hmm.
So I group my seeds in leaves and roots, fruits and flowers.
Yeah.
So those are how I group. So all my vegetables that give me leaves, so lettuce, arugula, broccoli, cauliflower, they will be cabbage, they will be all together in one container. Vegetables that gives me peppers, tomatoes, zucchini, squash, they will be in another.
Right.
And so on roots like carrots, carrots, radishes, beets, scallions, they will be in another container.
Yeah.
So they are grouped by produce, and those small things are in container, stored in a large container.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that they are in all, because there are people who can have a folder with sleeves where you can store your seeds, but drag all that to the field.
You're kind of stuck taking everything with you instead of just what you need.
The other thing is that if it's raining or wet, it might get wet the seed packets, so you don't want that. But if you have a container, so you just open your container, your big container, look for the selection of seeds you want, and take only that with you. And so it's kind of a easy way to bring everything, but not use everything, and everything is still protected.
Excellent. Well, these are a lot of great ideas. So tools, lots of different tools, and you're going to be able to find those at the garden store or off in the hardware store.
Yes.
Similar for some of the supplies, but some of these supplies even, you'd be able to find them at the dollar store even, really inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
Clothes. Where do you look online for clothing items?
Usually, Amazon. Yeah, everybody looks in there. Garden centers as well. They give some ideas. Some of the garden centers have some apparel with clothes and so we can visit there as well, and you may have an idea what it's you like to purchase.
Yeah, excellent. And then some of the other stuff, the gardening magazines you'll be able to find online. Seeds and tins for the seeds through the seed suppliers or the garden store.
Yeah, and sometimes in the recycling in your building. There is people who drink tea and they just discard the tins where the leaves are. So why not reuse that? So it's just,
And if you're a canner and you're canning your produce, you're also going to have a lot of jars that might make great seed containers.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get, and those are easy to find to get to some. And I guess if you have a canner, a garden canner, you know, jars and stuff are always.
Yeah. And one thing I will add to my my supplies or tools in there is a label, a printer of labels, printer. So yeah, so if you want to label everything, having a printer and can very clear display in there, so you know where things are.
Yeah, it really does make a difference when you have a lot of small little things, and you can, you know, just a little label. And they're done and easy to read for you and anyone else as well.
That's right. You know? Yeah, because you say, "Oh, can you pass me my thing with the leaf seeds? Like, where it is?"
Excellent idea. All right. Well, thank you, Pablo. Some great ideas for Christmas and for the gardeners in our lives. Thank you so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. You're the gardens manager. Tell us very quickly about Embark and some of the gardens programs you're running.
Yep. So Embark is now. Embark Sustainability is a non-profit organization based here in SFU. We serve to our large student community in campus. Embark manages two gardens here in campus, in Burnaby campus. One is behind the Maggie Bengston Field, and the other is in the third floor on the student building. We run gardening cohorts. Each gardening cohort lasts for 7 weeks, and we run four of them during the year. So one in spring, two in summer, one in fall. And now we are inviting gardeners or anyone who is interested in continue gardening or developing gardening skills or just wanting to be outside with more people and make friends to come and join us into a volunteer gardener volunteers. Because during this winter time we have lots to do still in our gardening. As we've been moving from last summer, we've been moving the garden to a new location. There's still a lot of labor to do, like wheeling soil. We have to move our trees. We have 7 trees, fruit trees, that needs to be moved to the new garden. So we are calling for volunteers to give us a hand on that. So it will be a bit more labor intensive than learning, but still, by once we are in gardening and doing this and that, we're always sharing some gardening tips.
You know, especially in winter, that can be really nice when you're spending a lot of time indoors, just to get out and do some good physical work, especially with a group of people. Then it's sort of a nice social exercise, and you come back feeling good because you've really worked your body.
That's right. So we are calling for our volunteers. We are going to start in the third week of January, and we will run until mid March. So we have a good few weeks there to work together.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas to you, Pablo,
to
everyone over at Embark. And thanks for these great Christmas tips.
Thank you. And happy holidays to everyone. Have a nice, restful winter. And we will meet each other in spring when the good weather will be around.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. We'll be back in the new year.
That's right. See you.
And we will be back in the new year. Gardening with Embark is, of course, on a break because the gardening season is on a break. But Pablo and I will be returning. We probably do, there'll be an episode in January just about planning and getting ready for the year ahead. And then we'll pick things up every week starting in March. So please look for season 3 in the new year. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and this is Speak Up. We had an interview with Dr. Esther Van Wagner about the Cowichan Tribe's Richmond land claims decision about Aboriginal title and what that decision and the larger concepts involved in it mean for the province going forward. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us about that, you can send us a message at 778-782-2573. We can take text messages at that number, and we'd love to hear from you. Lots more great programming coming up here on CJSF. In just a couple of minutes is Democracy Now! Up at 11. At noon is Wandering Rhythms, and up at 3 o'clock is Typically Tuesday. Tomorrow, another episode of Speak Up is coming to you at 10 o'clock with Danny Nesvadarani in the host chair. And also on Thursday with Jesse. And on Wednesday, the newly relaunched Intervenus will be coming to you at 10 o'clock with a whole slew of interviews and discussions and talks all around women and gender issues And I urge you to tune in for that. It's a great show and lots of interesting discussion. Stay tuned here on CJSF for a lot more great programming. We'll be back tomorrow, and Democracy Now! Is coming up right now.